Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, promoting informed discussion of issues related to California state governance and civic engagement. I'm Zabre Valentine, Director of Voices of Reform, and I want to thank you for joining us to discuss the question of why Californians should care about the budget process and how the budget process might be changed to work better for Californians. The Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. Today's program will be moderated by Dan Schnurr, political consultant and former communications director for John McCain's 2000 presidential campaign. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Schnurr. Mr. Schnurr is a founding principal of Command Focus, a Sacramento-based public affairs, communications, and campaign management firm. He's one of California's leading Republican political and media strategists whose record includes work on four presidential and three gubernatorial campaigns, as well as extensive experience on behalf of a variety of nonprofit organizations and private sector companies. Mr. Schnurr also teaches at both UC Berkeley and University of Southern California. He currently is a visiting instructor at the UCB's Institute of Governmental Studies and an adjunct professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication, where he teaches courses in politics and communications. Mr. Schnurr writes regularly for several California newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Sacramento Bee. In addition, he acts as an analyst and political commentator for CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. And now I'm very pleased to turn the program over to Dan Schnurr to moderate today's discussion.
Well, Zabre, thank you very much for having all of us here today, and my thanks as well to the Commonwealth Club and their Voices of Reform project. The event that you're attending this afternoon is one in a year-long series of similar conversations designed to get at the heart of the necessary reforms to improve California's broken political and governmental processes. And I am very happy to be joined here by an august panel of experts in the area of California's budget. And so I'd like to take just one moment and introduce all of them. I will apologize in advance for not reading their entire biographies, because given the amount of time that Zabre wasted reading mine, we would not have time for any conversation after the introductions. Fred Keeley, the treasurer and tax collector of Santa Cruz County, and former Democratic legislator, considered to be one of the California State Assembly's leading experts on the state budget. Tim Gage, the former director of the State Department of Finance, currently with Sacramento State University here in the state capitol. Peter Mijas, the superintendent of schools of Fresno County, who is a representative of the Education County, can speak firsthand to how effectively the state's budgeting process works. Assemblyman Roger Nilo, currently serving as a member of the Republican Assembly Caucus, and in addition to his time in the legislature, also spent several years as one of Sacramento's more prominent business people. And finally, Dan Walters, longtime columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Between our five panelists, while we may not reflect the demographic diversity that is California, we certainly reflect its ideological breadth. And what I'm hoping we can accomplish over the next hour is a conversation, number one, about why California's state budget does not work the way it ought to. Number two, why that is important, should be important to the average citizen. And number three, what can be done to improve that situation. So before I go to our panelists, let me, for all five of you, lay out to you the following suggestions around which we can base our conversation. Number one, as I think many of you in the audience are aware, California has recently concluded a special election. Perhaps you may have seen a television commercial or two about it over the course of the last several months. In that special election, Governor Schwarzenegger sponsored a ballot initiative, Proposition 76, which was an attempt on his part to address what he saw as the interesting problems with California's budget process. Supposition one, number one, whether you were a supporter of Proposition 76 or an opponent of it, let us agree that proposition, neither that proposition nor any reasonable facsimile of it, will become law in California in the near future. So number one, as we begin to address the problems that addresses California's state budget process, let's assume that that's off the table. And what I'd like to hear from you instead are other alternatives to fix a broken system. Supposition number two, of course, is that California's budget process does not work as effectively and as efficiently as it ought. And if someone on the panel disagrees with that supposition right now, it would probably be a good time to excuse yourself because, frankly, we don't want you here. And let us further define the intrinsic problem in California's budget process is the following. That when the state of California passes a budget each year, when the state legislature and the state's governor come to an agreement on the state's level of spending, that budget at some time over the course of the next 364 days may, in fact, even if it was once in balance, over the next 51 and a half weeks may fall out of balance. It is theoretically possible that revenue may not come into the state precisely to the penny that was anticipated by the passage of that budget. And let us also agree that the California state budget, all $100 billion of it, is unique in the public or private sector as the only entity that I know of that does not allow for any mid-course correction. If I am part of a two-wage earner family and either me or my spouse loses our job, we do not wait 51 and a half weeks for me to go out and look for a new job. Nor do we wait 51 and a half weeks in order to potentially reduce our spending to keep our budget balanced. If I run a small business and I lose a significant customer, I don't wait 364 days to go out and look for a new customer, nor do I wait 364 days before potentially reducing my payroll in order to address the needs of my new situation. But the California state budget, regardless of whether you think those mid-course corrections ought to include tax increases or spending cuts or some combination of both, does not allow for any mid-course correction. Proposition 76 attempted to address that situation, albeit unsuccessfully. Let's, as our second supposition, assume that that lack of mid-course corrective ability is a situation that ought to be addressed and ought to be corrected. And finally, let's assume, for the sake of putting aside partisanship here, and allowing our focus to rest on the process of California's budgeting rather than the solutions that either Democrats or Republicans are likely to suggest, let's assume that there is at least a plausible possibility that at some point in our lifetimes or the lifetimes of our children, that Republicans will enjoy a majority in one or both chambers of the California state legislature. And so as we talk about the balance of powers between governor and legislature, let's not assume, as was the case this year, a Republican governor and Democratic legislature, but in fact the possibility of the opposite taking place. So number one, Prop 76, support or oppose wasn't the answer. Number two, there's a problem in that the state of California can't fix an imbalanced budget until 51 and a half weeks after it passed its last budget. And number three, this is a situation that both parties need to address in a thoughtful manner. With that diatribe from your moderator, let me turn to our panelists and ask you to address the second of those two premises, the idea that the state budget process is broken because of the lack of corrective ability and what can be done to improve it. Dan Walters, you have watched the state of California struggle to balance its budget since time immemorial.
That's true.
You've watched both Democratic and Republican governors, Democratic legislators, and an occasional Republican legislative majority grappling with the same problem. What can be done to allow the state of California to balance its books in a more effective and efficient manner?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that could be done, but I think we ought to, first of all, recognize that the process is not really the fundamental problem. The process is flawed, certainly, and it prevents you from solving the problem, but it's not the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem of the budget process, of the budget, not the process, of the budget in California is simply that the totality of the demands on the public purse are greater than the ability of the tax system to generate, number one, over time, And secondly, that the while expenditures are fairly well locked into law, particularly those for schools, and cannot be easily reduced, even if you had midterm power to do so, that revenues themselves are quite volatile. And it's this volatility that lies at the heart of California's budget crisis. Because we have a revenue system that's primarily dependent on the personal income tax, the personal income tax is paid by a relative handful of high-income people, for the most part, and their incomes, in turn, are dependent largely on the fortunes of the stock market, capital gains and stock options. Then during good times, during expansive times, revenues ratchet up pretty strongly. And the formula and political imperatives both require that money to be spent, either on tax cuts or on new expenditures that are permanent in nature, but yet the revenue system can just as easily ratchet down during the next even mild downturn of the economy. And this creates a kind of a perpetual budget crisis. You have the two sides of the ledger so far out of balance, both in terms of numbers and in terms of the flow. Then you're bound to have a crisis. What Mr. Schnur suggests in terms of mid-course correction in the middle of the year might give you a tool to try to adjust to those changes. But there's nothing that actually prevents the legislature and the governor from making those midterm corrections now. It's just that the governor can't make them on his own. He had that power to make them on his own in terms of the spending side of the ledger up until George Dick Mason gave away the power about 25 years ago. There's nothing to prevent the governor and the legislature from revisiting the budget anytime they want to and change it anytime they want to. But the fact that they don't, by and large, and the fact that the budget kind of operates on its own, on autopilot, tells us there's something fundamentally right. During a period of great economic expansion in California, of high incomes, high corporate profits, to have still a structural budget deficit of 4 or 5 or 6% year after year tells you that there's something fundamentally awry in the structure of income and outgo in California.
Okay. Fred Keeley, you toiled within the legislature for not quite as many years as Dan Walters covered it, but you certainly earned your stripes through a series of budget battles. Dan Walters suggests that there is nothing that prevents a legislature and a governor from making these admittedly difficult decisions, particularly when faced with a very volatile revenue situation. I'd suggest that he is correct that there is not a legal obstacle to that, but there are political and cultural obstacles, if you will, to that decision-making process resolving itself the way it might. Can you talk for a minute about what goes on inside the building as a member through that negotiating process trying to make those kind of decisions?
Sure, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity to participate in this. And I'm happy to be a member of the Diversity Caucus here. I want to let me try to deal with a couple of those issues, Dan. My personal experience when I was in the legislature is that it is such an incredible task to get to a budget that when that is finished, there are very few people interested in paying attention to it after that. And, in fact, a large number of members of the legislature, a very large number, have almost nothing to do with the budget during the process where there is no budget and then you get a budget. It's a relatively small handful. It's probably something like 10 or 12 members of the legislature out of 120 who are really involved in it. There are some mechanisms for the ledge and the governor to try to make mid-course corrections, whether those are the actions of the Joint Legislative Budget Committee or the so-called Section 27, Section 28 letters. There are ways to make some mid-course corrections. They're largely sort of technical and procedural. But the issue that Dan has raised and that you have raised is an interesting one because you have framed it up in a way that is not wrong from your point of view. But let me suggest another point of view about this issue about how to correct things as you're going along. Let's say, for example, that you were in the budget year, you have an adopted budget, and you realize that in quarter number one or in month number two, the revenues are underperforming. And the two big revenue sources are the personal income tax and the state share of sales tax. By the time, unless you want to cede to the governor the authority unilaterally to make mid-course corrections, unless you want to cede that authority, which I would suggest is not a good idea, to be able to make changes in the budget are really, really difficult to do, if not impossible, in month-long periods of time, and are probably not a good idea, because what can go down can go up, can go sideways, can go whatever. And I don't think the powers of prediction, as good as they are at UCLA in forecasting or other places, they aren't precise enough, certainly, to be able to tell you this quarter it's going to look like this and this quarter it's going to look like that. I think that the more serious issue really is, has four parts to it. 85% of the budget is locked up before any governor has anything to say about it or any member of the legislature has anything to say about it. The two-thirds vote requirement to adopt a budget, which only Rhode Island and Arkansas and California have. All other states have a majority vote requirement, which then imposes on the majority the responsibility as well as the authority to get a budget on time. The tremendous volatility of our two general fund revenue sources, and in my judgment, something that's not talked about very often, not booking anywhere on the budget or in the budget document tax credits as an expenditure. They are every bit as much an expenditure as spending a dollar on education or health care or anything else, but there is no listing of tax credits. And they are a legal fiction that somebody paid their taxes who didn't pay their taxes. So that has to be accounted for in the budget. And it is a very long list of special interests. That is not a pejorative term in my view, because I think there's some special interests who get tax credits that I'm very happy about it. But it is a long list of special interests who get a fiction created in law that they've paid their taxes and they haven't. And somebody then has to put that on the table, and that's an expenditure. So those, I think, are the nature of the problem. I actually think that if the ledge and the governor and the people of California want to get serious about fixing this, I think there are a couple of things we can do about it. And they really grow out of two of the most recent failures where there were opportunities to do something good but didn't get it right. One is the California Performance Review, which the governor said in his first State of the State address, I came here to blow up the boxes. And then what ensued from that was a very long effort to put out a series of recommendations that alleged that if they were implemented would save $32 billion in 5 years. The problem with it was that it wasn't a document that was driven from the perspective of what are you managing towards. So to take a very micro example, there was a suggestion that there's 9 regional water quality control boards and 1 state water resources control board. And so an idea was get rid of the regional water quality control boards, expand the authority of the state board, and that'll be a more efficient, effective government. Okay. Is that a good idea or not a good idea? And there were thousands of pages of these kinds of ideas. The predicate question is, what are you managing towards in terms of water in California? How clean do you want it? By what date? You're willing to spend how much money? And what metrics do you have to assure that you're getting there? If you don't ask those questions, then any budget reform is as good as any other budget reform. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. So what I would actually suggest is two phases. One is, I think it would be good for the people of this state, through their elected representatives in the executive and legislative branch, to say, we really are going to have a thoughtful review of what the government is trying to get done. Not its outputs, but its outcomes. How clean do you want the water by when? How clean do you want the air by when? How affordable do you want housing, and what's the government's role? What is the educational product going to deliver in the K-12 school system? What are the outcomes that we want? And then you can say, literally, that costs this much to do these things. And then it isn't about we have a budget problem, and and the assembly member of his caucus are all likely to say, yes, we have a budget problem, and the budget problem is there's too much spending. And the members of the caucus I used to be part of would say, yes, there's a budget problem, and there isn't enough spending. We both agree there's a budget problem, but we see it in different ways. One way to break through that is for Roger and his colleagues in the Republican caucus and my former colleagues in the Assembly caucus to say, Democratic caucus, to say, what kind of California do we want to live in? And what role does government play in getting this piece done and this piece done and this piece done and this piece done? Because if you can't answer that question, what purpose is the government serving? And I think then that drives you to the issue of whether or not Roger in the Republican caucus and the folks in the Democratic caucus could say, well, these programs need to be reduced in their spending because they're not helping us get to our objective, whatever it may be. And correlatively, it is okay to go to the voters and say, we want to increase the sales tax or its application to include a broader group of services, or currently almost doesn't cover any services, in order to fund these activities where we're really underinvesting in California. So that's my sense of how you might want to work through it.
I think what Fred has done, and it's been a very welcome addition to the conversation, is taken a very specific conversation about state budget priorities and put it in a broader context. In other words, a budget, if I understand you right, is a blueprint for broader philosophic priorities. Make those broader philosophical decisions first and then fill in the numbers to reflect them, rather than the other way around. Tim Gage, that sounds perfectly logical to me. You served as director of finance for a governor. You served as a chief finance advisor to Senate majority leaders. Why is the overriding logic that is Fred Keeley not the way of the land inside California government?
I've been wondering that, too.
Inquiring minds would like to know. Well, let me first set the record straight. Even though I live very close to Sacramento State University, I'm not actually affiliated with the university.
I apologize.
But I like them very much. not the least of which reason is because we get to take walks through the campus. But let me address the question. And I think you're right that Fred Keeley has framed the discussion very well. Part of the reason why we don't have these kinds of solutions at this point is because we haven't had that conversation, the conversation that Fred Keeley just talked about in terms of developing a consensus in California as to what kind of state we want to have, what kind of services we want to have. In fact, quite the contrary, California, if you look at some of the polling data that's been available over the last 9 months to a year, is divided just about down the middle on the question of do we want to be a state that charges somewhat higher taxes and provides a high level of services, or do we want to be a state that provides for fewer services and as a consequence charges fewer taxes. In fact, the Public Policy Institute of California polling shows that voters in the state are absolutely evenly divided at 43% each on each side of that question, but for the statistical variation. And so the difficulty is we haven't had that conversation that would enable policymakers such as the legislature or the governor to advance a consensus view of what kind of California we've got. Now, that having been said, are we likely to get, given that in some sense ideological, perhaps philosophical divide, are we likely to get that consensus anytime soon? I don't really know, but as yet we haven't made, I don't think, the kind of effort we need to put forward to develop that consensus. And while it may not be possible to achieve it across the board, I would say that we could probably get consensus around certain kinds of issues, the importance of spending, for instance, on certain kinds of public programs. So I think what we've got is a context where we don't yet have that consensus, and then that runs headlong into the kind of somewhat more mechanical problems with the budget that you and Dan Walters talked about, which is the volatility of the state's revenue base, the fact that we have a budget where spending is locked in and not susceptible to much in the way of adjustment by the legislature or the governor. And I have to say that I agree with Mr. Keeley in one particular respect, and that is it probably doesn't make sense, even though it would be a useful thing for a governor to have some capacity to adjust spending at the margin during the middle of the year, given the kinds of changes that would need to be made to expenditures and to funding for programs in order to adjust for a serious disruption in revenues. I don't think it makes sense necessarily to lodge in the executive branch alone the ability to change wholesale those kinds of spending priorities. And I'm probably speaking from my legislative experience rather than my executive branch experience in that respect. But, you know, it really needs to be part of that consensus building that we do.
Well, clearly the voters of California agree with that portion of your assessment. And to get back to the more specific question, I think there seems to be general agreement that a shared responsibility for those decisions is the most appropriate way to progress. Let me ask you a question, Roger Nilo. You're currently a member of the State Assembly, spent the better part of your career working in the private sector, so that clearly required a basic change in set of assumptions and how you and your colleagues go about doing their jobs. But I want to come back again to something that Fred Keeley said. And for the sake of this discussion, I'll apologize in advance, Fred. I'm going to intentionally misrepresent a point that you made, if that's not a problem. What Fred Keeley seemed to suggest was going back to the beginning, saying rather than simply tweaking here and adjusting there, let's go back and decide what kind of state we want to have, what we want to spend money on, who we're willing to ask money from and to what degree, and on the basis of that broader blueprint, then begin to make budget decisions. To an uneducated mind such as myself, that sounds suspiciously like a proposal that is floated every few years called zero-based budgeting. The idea of starting at the core and building upward rather than making adjustments based on previous year's expenditures and revenues. Is there an advisability in that type of approach? Or is your experience now as a member of the legislature such that it's not a possible alternative, or both?
Well, Fred's suggestion is at the very least an interesting one, and I would say from a philosophic standpoint, and also perhaps from a longer term standpoint, it would be a very good idea to attempt, and I would endorse that. It would be part of a zero-based budgeting approach. And then the zero-based budgeting, that would have to be a foundation for zero-based budgeting, and then you move on to the details of the budget from there. My concern about that, though, is that in the reality of our existence and the reality of the situation, I don't think that we have time in the near term to go through those steps. Certainly not for the 05-06 budget, and I think arguably perhaps in terms of a quality outcome, perhaps not for a few budget years. Again, for a quality outcome. My assessment of the budget process is drawn from not only my private sector experience, but I did spend 6 years on the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors. And we actually went through an exercise like that and said, priorities, and then that was intended to guide us in our budget deliberations. Setting the priorities was difficult enough, and by the way, there were only five of us rather than 120.
Right.
But the setting of priorities in the abstract doesn't necessarily perfectly translate to the actual priority decisions that you go through when you start actually allocating dollars, particularly when you get down to the few that are left. Now, Dan, I'm happy to accept your presumption that Prop 76 was then and this is now, but there are some aspects of Prop 76 that I believe is part of the dysfunction of the way that we approach the budget in the legislature, and I experienced this at the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors also, and that is, in my opinion, particularly given existing realities, but in my opinion, prudent budgeting requires First of all, obviously, that you don't spend more than you receive. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But particularly with the volatility of revenues that that Dan Walters talked about, when income is strong, you actually have to hold back and not spend all that so that when times are not quite as good, you have money to make up the difference so that you even out your expenditures.
Just to clarify here on a quick follow-up, so what you're suggesting is going to the special interests that Fred Keeley categorized in an extremely non-judgmental way. You go to those special interests and say, yes, we have money to help you meet your needs, but we're not going to give it to you.
That's part of a budget maker's job. And we do it every year. I did it much more up close and personal when I was on the Board of Supervisors, because Fred is right. On the assembly floor, we are handed a proposal that is crafted by other people, and we voted up or down. When I was on the Board of Supervisors, I was actually crafting the proposal, and it is a uniquely exciting place to be when you're deciding to spend and not spend money. And even if you spend everything you've got in a good year, you're still deciding not to spend some money. But the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, that is, first of all, prudent budgeting. And secondly, when we have formula-based expenditures that are discreetly decided upon and set up in isolation, that is to say, Prop 98 was voted in without regard to competing expenditures. It was just an individual, independent priority with regard to education. And when you have that particular situation, it makes it even more important that there be some sort of umbrella control over total spending. Those were concepts of Prop 76, and I'm just not prepared to abandon those and pretend that that they've gone away. I still believe, from my standpoint, those are fundamental prudent approaches in a budgeting process, and I don't think that we should take those concepts off the table.
No, and my point simply being that in the aftermath of the election, they are unlikely to be implemented into law in the immediate future, and therefore perhaps there are other solutions that incorporate what you and your fellow panelists have been talking about instead. Peter Mijas, you are the superintendent of the Fresno Public Schools.
County Office of Education.
And therefore you occupy a space that is a very safe distance from the state capitol.
Not safe enough.
what that means, and I think this is good because it allows us to take the conversation from, if you excuse the expression, the legislative to the practical. This allows us to talk for a moment at least about how this impacts real people. You're on the receiving end of this. Aside from the fact, let's just assume for the sake of money, that the state legislature will never, ever, ever, ever be able to provide enough resources for everyone in the state of California to be happy, just as an assumption. That aside, what is it about the way that Roger Nilo and Fred Keeley and their colleagues, current and former, do their job? What is it about it that makes you crazy?
Everything?
Well, since we're not serving cheese, I'll try to spare you the wine and sniveling. I think it was Albert Einstein who said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing you've always done but expecting different results. I was a poli-sci major before coming up and having the privilege of serving with Governor Duke Majan. And I taught American government. After spending 7.5 years up here, I realized that what I was really teaching was mythology. because the reality, here's the reality of it. The current system, in my humble opinion, is Byzantine and convoluted. The legislature doesn't give us a budget until, if we're lucky, until July. But yet we as school administrators have to commit contracts, and obviously education is labor intense. 85% of your money is directed towards labor. But yet we must have a budget, an approved budget, before we know what the state is going to provide for us. And by March 15th, because the law has been set and influenced strongly by special interests, we must notify people whether or not they have a job or not. And particularly in California, when we have such mobile student population, And our funding is based upon ADA. And so it is insanity to try. We play a guessing game. And that's why at times we try to provide for fiscal uncertainties that school districts are required with a reserve. But what happens is, under the current system, we get spikes, and then we get these downfalls. When Governor Davis gave the schools 11.5% raise, immediately CTA said, that's all for salaries and benefits. In Fresno, no one worried about the cut in music programs and art programs. 11.5%, boy, that was gone for the COLA and for salaries and benefits. I guess what bothers me the most is when we say Prop 98 is a guarantee. In my humble opinion, using guarantee in government, it's an oxymoron. Because you can't suspend it. When push comes to shove, if you have the political will, you can't suspend it. And so what bothers me is we have a convoluted system. If we look prior to, say, to the 50s, and prior to Serrano Priest, prior to Prop 13, 80% of the funds came locally. But then more and more funds now, maybe very few, and prior to the Second World War, maybe 2% came from the feds. We're up to about 7, 9% from the feds now. But the majority of the money comes from the state. And not to be poetic, but when the state controls the majority of the money, then the golden rule kicks in. He who has the gold rules. And that's why we have 11 volumes of education code, because we have all these educational experts up here making decisions, categories. The categorical programs have obviously gone wild in terms of not only can we make decisions on where to spend our money, it's told to us where it's going to go. And when you create all these categoricals, and I'm not an ordained minister, so I'm not going to preach now, but the reality is, to implement those categoricals, you have to have a bureaucracy to administer it. And so the current system, from a recipient's point of view, and then the absolute height of insanity, this last go-around, we said, you know, in Fresno County alone, I can save you $6 million because I can outsource some things. We were prevented from doing so. The state legislature had AB 1419 and said, no, you can't outsource unless you get permission from the bargaining units. Now, when we said, we're not going to ask for any more money, we can save you money. I save money with my special ed transportation before this law was passed that goes right back into special ed, wasn't allowed to do so. So I guess what I'm saying is that if we're going to hold people accountable, and every time we have the discussion, 33 other states have looked at what is adequacy of funding. What does it really cost to turn out a quality education for people? We're chasing a moving target. We said, well, we'll compare ourselves to other states, but have we sat down and really said, in order to have proficiency of the majority of our students, this is the goal we're going to work towards. This is what it's going to cost as a state to be committed to education. Lastly, what really bothers me about these fixed formulas, I could be very, very myopic and say, gee, for education, yeah, we got our share. But the children I serve also need mental services. And if we get our share, fire and police protection, we work very closely now with law enforcement. But if they get draconian cuts, doesn't that hurt us in education in the long run? And so I've always felt is I'd rather take my chances with the legislature if we're doing a good job that they will see necessary to adequately fund us. But when we get supposedly a guarantee, that's almost an entitlement. And it says whether or not we have 118 schools, low-performing schools in Fresno County, you get the money anyway. Doesn't make any difference. We're going to give you a set amount of money. So I would hope we begin to look at the state budgeting process. And when you talk about mid-year cuts. Mid-year cuts, we already have people contracted. And to come along at mid-year and tell us, oh, by the way, we're not going to cut X number off your budget really presents a problem. So I think we really need to look at how we are funding our schools, getting rid of, giving us more flexibility. And I'm glad right now the state has adopted the standards, has adopted the high school exam, is keeping us on course. because it's beginning to work, but I think we need some stabilization, some consistency in our funding process.
Well, although it was presented in a very different way, it sounds to me what Peter Mijas is asking for is that broader philosophical overview that each of our panelists has decided is an important precursor to the actual number crunching of the budget process. Now, Peter raised a few good points. One is the relationship between state and local government, which I am afraid we don't have the time to delve into adequately here. However, the Commonwealth Club Voices of Reform Project also sponsors a telethon hosted by Jerry Lewis, and we don't leave the air until we've successfully addressed state and local government relationship. So please join us on Labor Day for that. In the meantime, though, he raises the topic of ballot box budgeting, which I'd like to come back to in just a minute. But the other point he raises, Fred Keeley, is the question of predictability. And as a county official, my guess is that you have some appreciation for that thought, the idea of knowing from year to year essentially what the state is going to be providing for you and asking of you in the county of Santa Cruz. So let's take that question of predictability and couple it with the point that Roger Nilo made. He agreed with you that that broader philosophical framework is a good idea and acknowledged what I think most of the people on this panel would agree is a reality, that over the course of a legislative session, the time just doesn't exist for that. In the rush to accomplish what is urgent, that broader good is rarely examined. So take the question of predictability. Take the question of lack of time. Should California have a two-year or a multi-year budgeting process so that we don't go through this same process January, May, September, and have more time for the kind of questions the others on the panel have raised?
Thank you. I don't think that a two-year budget is per se a bad idea at all. And I think there is a way to get to this issue of essentially examining piece by piece over several years what kind of California do we want to live in and what is the appropriate role of the state government and its constituent service deliverers at the local level. How do they do that and how much does it cost? For example, and a two-year budget would be helpful in this regard. For example, you could say, as the Wilson administration said, they took a handful of departments and said, we're going to try a performance-based budgeting approach. I don't think it was entirely successful. It was narrowly focused, but at least they tried it. I think you could take, for example, on an agency basis. You could say we're going to start with Cal EPA and the Resources Agency, or we're going to start with education, or we are going to start with corrections, or we're going to start with whatever. And you could say here is the plan. We're going to have in the next 3 years or 5 years, we are going to step ourselves across from this system that we've got now to a system that is essentially outcome-driven, and we are going to have a performance-based system. And that will help us define what kind of California we want to live in and therefore what the appropriate level of spending and governmental programs that need to attend to that. Now, let me say this in that regard. I think that one of the things, because Proposition 98 and Proposition 13 have been referenced here, I'm part of a generation of elected officials that came into public life after Proposition 13. And in California, since Proposition 13, there has been an enabling conversation between elected officials and the taxpayers and voters. And that enabling conversation kind of goes like this. The elected officials, whether they are Republican or Democrat, say, here's what we would like. If I'm elected, Roger's going to do certain things, and the People's Republic of Santa Cruz that I come from, you know, it's a different set of things. But we all come here and we want to get a certain set of things done. But probably not Roger and probably not me were on the campaign trail saying, and we're going to raise taxes to do whatever it takes to get that to happen. And instead there's this enabling conversation that's kind of a wink and a nod, which is I'll get you – the cleanest water, the cleanest air, the most compassionate correction system, the best possible affordable housing participation by the state, the most efficient transportation system, and so on and so on. And that's where, if you're a Democrat, you kind of then trail off. If you're a Republican, you say, I'm going to go to Sacramento and make sure that these people keep spending under control. We're not going to raise taxes. And, by the way, we're going to make sure you get the best possible education and the cleanest air and the cleanest water and, you know, prisoners locked up for a very long time and the key thrown away, et cetera. So fair enough to have those differences in points of view. But it is an enabling and fictional conversation. It suggests that in a state growing at 500,000 people a year and changing demographically where the majority doesn't look like us, and in the next census, it's going to look like Antonio Villaraigosa and Liz Figueroa. It is going to be a younger Latino majority in the state of California. This fiction that somehow you can have the kind of government you want in a state growing at 500,000 people a year and never put the question of a tax increase on the table is a fictional conversation. And we ought to have a grown-up conversation. I'm hoping next year in the governor's race there's a grown-up, mature conversation about that. That doesn't commit the governor or the Democratic nominee to raise taxes, but we ought to stop having this fictional conversation that somehow the problems with budgeting and service delivery are the kinds of things that I talked about earlier. They're all procedural. You know, it's a two-thirds vote here, and it's a, you know, fixed-in, locked-in thing over there and so on. Those are contributing factors, but I think the larger factor is that issue, is that we have to stop acting as if you can have the government you want and not pay for it.
You're listening to a discussion of California's budget process and how it might be made more effective, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project. Roger Nilo, I take it
– call on me after that.
I take it you agree with Fred's definition of the mature conversation that needs to take place in the next election. On the off chance there's any area of disagreement, feel free to express yourself.
Well, absolutely, we have to discuss these things because we do battle in an arena of ideas, and I don't quite have the same vision of that revenue world that Fred does. The fact of the matter is we have had substantial tax increases. If we just look at the revenue that the state's taken in years past to what the state's taken in now, revenues are up. What Fred is talking about is tax rate increases. And that's where I and my colleagues in the Republican caucus distance ourselves from that. Certainly we can talk about it, and it would be foolish to say that we can never discuss it, because we need to be able to articulate and justify that vision of the world that we have. But the fact of the matter is, at least we believe, that if you seriously look at rates of tax increases on the order that is sometimes suggested by the members of the colleague that the caucus that Fred came from, we believe you begin harming the economy, which then begins to push down aggregate tax revenues. So we just have a different view of the world insofar as the revenue generation is concerned. While I agree that the review of what the state ought to do, what sort of outcomes we should expect from our efforts, therefore have guiding principles for budget deliberations is a very good idea. That does not mean that we have to raise tax rates to accomplish that.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Roger.
I was finished.
Okay, well, then I'm not sorry at all. question for Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee. Tim Gage earlier mentioned a Public Policy Institute of California poll, which showed almost a precise and equal division in terms of these type of priorities when it comes to the governance of California. If you assume that Fred Keeley represents the wishes of his constituents or his former constituents just as precisely as Roger Nilo represents the views of his constituents,
How do you get these two to agree on anything?
Well, I'm not so sure that you do. Actually, the budget problem we face in California, this chronic budget problem, is actually a microcosm of what I think is a larger crisis of governance in California. And that's simply this. This is the most diverse society that's ever existed in the history of humankind. Diverse not only in ethnic terms, but in economic terms, cultural terms, by any geographic, economic, any way you want to divide us. And it's very difficult to find consensus with that, you know, within that diversity. In fact, it becomes more and more difficult all the time. But a precursor to political action in the American system of government is some level of consensus, at least broad consensus, because we have checks and balances. And you've heard reference to them today, the two-thirds vote, the initiative process, the referendum, all these things that are processes that are essentially checks and balances. It's American system of government. You read the Federalist Papers, there it is. Nobody wants to give anybody too much power. It was really the complaint against Proposition 76 by the opponents. It would give the governor too much power. But it's a conundrum. The conundrum is this. If the American system of government requires consensus because it's so easy to stop something from happening, then the consensus becomes ever more difficult to obtain in a society that becomes ever more complex, maybe we're just testing the limits of the American system of government to function at all once society reaches a certain level of complexity, and it manifests itself most prominently in the budget. That, yes, a certain number of people think we should do more and tax more, and a certain number of people think we should do less or the same and tax less, perhaps. But it's the complex. We don't know what we want. This is an electorate in California that threw out a governor 2 years ago because he couldn't solve a budget crisis. And then the following year, last year, decisively defeated a measure to make it easier to raise taxes to resolve that crisis. And then this year, decisively defeated a measure to resolve that crisis through making spending cuts. So it raises this question, what do we really want? And the answer is we don't know. And I don't believe that the legislature can answer that question. It can represent certain aspects of that question, but the larger question is really a civic question rather than a purely political one. What do we want in California? And the question is, we don't know what we want. We have no idea what we want, and the institutions that exist in California do not facilitate the answering of the question. And so we just revolve or go round and round and round and round and round and never get anywhere, and government basically spins its wheels. It doesn't make so many wrong decisions, although it's made some doozies along the way, but it makes no decisions. The thing goes on year after year, and not only on the budget, but on water, on energy, on transportation, on education, on a jillion different subjects. And it's all part of this crisis of governance. That maybe the American system of government, the unique system that we use in America and we adopted in California and added a few more extra little things like the two-thirds vote, just doesn't work very well when you reach this level of complexity. And maybe we ought to start with the clean sheet of paper we ought to start with is designing a whole new structure of government that represents, that can work in a society that's as complex as California is and will be even more complex in the years and years ahead.
We will set aside the plausibility of a constitutional monarchy for a future panel discussion. But Dan Walters raises, I think, some very valid points. We heard from a current Republican and a former Democratic legislature, both very intelligent, very able, very articulate, very calm people, articulating two very different visions of government. Peter Mijas, from your perch out in the real world, is Dan Walters right? Are Californians getting the government they deserve, or is that an unfair assessment of their needs and their priorities?
Since I'm not running again for office, I would agree with Dan and say we are schizophrenic. We on these complex issues, just trying to engage the discussion on, for example, Prop 76. I was out talking to many, many folks on that. And when you get into these it's difficult through the initiative process to engage major policy issues. So I would agree with Dan that we do need to look at our structure because I believe in many respects, particularly, we in education, obviously, we have a very, very special interest. And here in Sacramento, everybody knows. Everybody knows that the most powerful influence in education isn't AXA, isn't school board, is CTA. They determine educational policy time and time again. And I'm not so sure that that CTA does represent the rank and file person. But I, let me just simply say, as I agree with Dan, I think that as I get out and talk to people on these issues, they have. It's almost it would be a lot easier if they were in fact 75-25, but it seems that it's almost 50-50. We're in a kind of a situation where there's not a clear majority on what we want. We're sort of divided.
Tim Gage, you worked as the director of finance for a governor who tried mightily to work with members of both parties to achieve balanced budgets during his term in office. What we've heard over the last several minutes here are a couple of suppositions. Number one, that the problems that the state of California faces are too complicated for the average voter to sift through and come to an informed decision. The second, the previous supposition, is that there is a series of well-moneyed special interests, no judgment attached to the term special, unique interests, if you'd prefer, that pay an inordinate amount of attention to the goings-on inside the state capitol. My question to you, Tim, having worked for both the governor and legislators, is there a way to protect the state's elected officials from those special interests, from the pressures that they face, and open up new avenues of communication with the voters? Or are Fred Keeley, Roger Nilo, and their mutual partisan descendants just condemned to a life of conflicted voters and insatiable special interests?
You know, I think there probably are some ways, although it probably goes beyond the scope of our discussion here in some respects, because those influences are very powerful and they do very much have an impact on the kind of decision making that goes on in Sacramento. But I think part of the way in which you break down some of that pressure is, again, to go back to what we talked about a little bit earlier, is having that conversation with the voters, with the public, having the more honest conversation with the voters about, you know, if we're going to provide a certain level of services, then this is what it's going to cost. But I think an important piece of that conversation also has to be exactly what Fred Keeley talked about in terms of establishing a level of credibility about government, the way it's operated, and the services it provides by talking about ways in which we can make government operate more effectively, more efficiently with the resources that it already has. I think particularly Democrats have not done as good a job as we should to ensure that that conversation is had, not only the conversation is had, but we actually try and deliver on that promise of making sure that we have that more effective operation of government, because I think what that helps do is establish more in the way of credibility with the voters that then enables the conversation about what level of services do we want, what level of taxes do we want to have occur. If that can happen, plus other things that are probably not within our scope today in terms of mitigating the influence of unique interests on the political process, then I think there probably is some hope that we could begin to develop some consensus. I think it's going to be isolated consensus, focused in particular areas, but we can build on that.
Okay. We are nearing the end of our prescribed time period. However, the organizers of this event have graciously allowed us a bit more time. For those of you who have to be somewhere immediately and only counted on 60 minutes of this type of discussion, you're free to leave. But I think what we'd like to do is spend just a few minutes mining these five brains just a little bit more ruthlessly before we set them loose on the rest of society. Dan Walters, Tim Gage just talked about the prospects for compromise, the prospects for accommodation, and I'm paraphrasing. To take this conversation from the metaphysical down to the practical, looking ahead over the next 12 months between now and the election of a governor 51 weeks from now, what prospects do you see for that type of compromise between the governor and the legislature, and in what areas?
I think it's entirely possible there may be an accommodation between this governor and this legislature on the budget next year. The revenues are up. The legislative analyst just put out a new report saying that the state could finance its baseline budget over the next year without either tax increases or dipping into further borrowing, which would be a blessing, I suppose. but also pointed out that there is a structural deficit, that ongoing, even despite our very prosperous economy, that that revenues will continue to lag baseline spending, and that assumes that we do not increase spending, and we now have, as I think everybody would agree, a weakened governor. The victors are going to claim their spoils. They're going to want the $3 billion that they kept hammering the governor over that they believe is due to them. There are proposals for expansive health care and whatnot. The state does have a little windfall of revenues, but I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of political pressure to spend that windfall, to increase spending, very much like happened in, although on a smaller scale, what happened in 1999 and 2000. It led to our current dilemma. So I think the governor and the legislature, at least the Democratic part of the legislature, could come to an agreement pretty easily. Whether Roger Nilo and his colleagues go along with that is another story altogether. But it doesn't do anything about the longer-term structural deficit. We have it. It's there. The totality of the demands and the totality of current law and current political priorities, you're not going to shut down the prisons. We're not going to close the colleges. Adds up to more than the revenue system can generate year after year after year, as the legislative analyst points out. And we have to – that's why we need this dialogue. That's why we need to talk about consensus. That's why we need to talk about what do we really want and what are we willing to pay for it. But no governor, in my experience – I've been here for 30 years – has ever wanted to carry on that conversation. Nobody's gone out and said, hey, folks, there are no free lunches here. If you want this, this is what it's going to cost. We've pretended to continue that. What Fred, was it Fred who called it this fictional conversation or this enabling conversation where we can have all things good and it's not going to cost you anymore? And the Democrats do that, and the Republicans do that, and nobody really wants to say the emperor has no clothes. And California continues to have, in the midst of unprecedented prosperity, a structural budget deficit that should be our shame. We have the lowest credit rating of any state in the United States currently. And that should be a point of shame, not pride.
Peter Mijas, is it going to take a tax increase of some type to adequately fund California K-12 education?
Well, I think the debate has always been either you're for efficiencies or you're for more spending. I think it's going to take both. I can tell you after 44 years of being in this system that there are ways that we can save substantial amounts of money in education and put it where obviously it makes a difference between the student and the teacher. And, yes, I think in some areas that is going to take but first I think we need to look at how we're spending our money, whether it's at the county level, at the state level, at the school site level. And I can just tell you, I can identify substantial savings, but I also think that it's going to take, given the student population we have, given the fact that we have these high standards, which I think our students can meet, it's going to take a combination of both.
So more funding and more efficient funding.
Yes, I believe so. In the right areas.
Okay, we'll set aside the conversation of the right areas again for a future panel. Tim, you've got your finger on the pulse of this legislature. A chastened governor has just offered them an olive branch, if you will. It seems to me, at least from my perspective, that the Senate pro tem has accepted that olive branch. The Assembly speaker has been a little bit more reluctant to do so. Whether it's accomplished in the way that Dan Walters or Peter Mijas suggests or not, what are the prospects in the aftermath of the results of this special election, in your opinion, for the legislative leadership to come back to the table and work with the governor, and assuming that they are willing to, what do you see is the threshold price for joining him?
You know, I think ultimately they will, because I think all of the elected officials in Sacramento, or virtually all, ultimately are interested in serving their constituents and serving the public's interest in terms of seeing if there are areas of consensus that they can agree upon. As to the price, it's difficult to say. You know, I think it depends on what constellation of issues presents themselves. I think certainly the new information that the legislative analyst's office has provided as of today as to the picture of the state's finances going forward will potentially change that dynamic slightly. There certainly will be trade-offs. There'll be accommodations made, but I think that ultimately they will have that conversation and they will reach consensus around some issues.
But what Dan Walters suggests is that those will be accommodations of convenience, if you will, to get through this next fiscal year's budget cycle without addressing in a satisfactory manner those longer-term budget challenges and the structural imbalance that you've all spoken of.
I think that's probably fair. I mean, one of the things that the state suffers from in the budget process, and I don't know necessarily that a two-year budget process would solve this, but one of the things that the state doesn't have is the ability to figure out where to invest funds that may not have a payoff immediately, but 3 or 4 or 5 years hence would actually reduce costs that the state is going to face for a particular program or delivering a particular service. And that's partly because of term limits. It's partly because the budget process is of a very short duration in terms of the focus that folks put on it. And so one of the things we need to do is to figure out how do we identify those opportunities for investment and how do we restructure the budget process so that we can accommodate them. On the flip side of that question, one of the things that might help engender some additional responsibility with respect to spending is some sort of a pay-as-you-go mechanism in the legislative process. Very tough to enforce. Congress has had it in the federal budget process off and on for a number of years, and there's no magic about it. It's really about disciplining yourself, your caucus, the legislature generally, and the government generally with respect to what things can you realistically do within the resources that you've got. But some of those things might offer some opportunities to develop some more sensible approaches to the long-term picture than we've currently got.
One of the things that I've taken from this conversation is that there's only so much that legal or political or structural changes can do to force individuals of both parties to confront these more difficult and longer-term problems, given the realities of the political pressures that they face on an ongoing basis. Tim's just offered us a fairly optimistic, somewhat vague view of opportunities for progress. So I'm going to put our two members, current and former, on the spot, and ask you to identify or to predict one area of public policy in the foreseeable future where you believe that your party's legislators would be willing to defy conventional wisdom, to cross party lines, to make the extra effort toward compromise, to break out of their ideological box, if you will, and I'm being intentionally pejorative. What area of public policy do you see Roger Needle for Republicans and do you see Fred Keeley for Democrats to reach across that divide and achieve the kind of progress that Tim Gage alluded to?
Well, there have been examples in the recent past of members of my caucus that appeared to be crossing that divide in terms of Republicans that have supported budgets that was not popular with the caucus, and I'd point out that in all cases they're no longer there, prematurely retired. And then there are two current members of each caucus that proposed an alternative budget before the, I believe it was the 04-05 budget that didn't go anywhere.
Let me just add on to the question then real quick. Is it possible for a member of the California State Legislature of either party?
Yeah, I'm saying it is possible.
Without suffering the consequences. Where?
The problem behind that, Dan, is, you know, we talk about the schizophrenic voting public, but you can't – the voting base is not a single individual. We got the 43% with one view of the world, my view of the world. We got the 43% of the electorate with Fred's view of the world. They don't change much. And by the way, the 40% I mentioned first is the one that elected me, at least within my district. I'd like to think because of my good looks and charm and articulate nature and intelligence, but the fact of the matter is, the fact of the matter is that they elected me because they agree with me in my articulated views. So it makes it difficult to do that. The problem with the so-called schizophrenic electorate is that there's that 14% that changes, that swing that is neither the base nor of the Republicans nor the Democrats. So there are rooms for compromise at the margin. I'm not going to predict what they are. But fundamental sea changes of fundamental philosophy would be pretty tough to get to, I think.
Fred?
I think there's probably a couple of specific areas where the legislature and the governor will want to try to work together. I will start by saying, however, when I was in the legislature and I was Speaker pro tem, basically my job was I ran a wonky policy shop for three speakers and wasn't expected to do a whole bunch of the politics. That was kind of left to other people in leadership. So I'm not a real sort of, I don't have a good feel for all the political stuff. I'm a little more wonky, or a lot more wonky. But I think that there will be an initial inclination on the part of Democrats not to accept the governor's invitation to come in and share the misery that he's enjoying right now. Misery does love company, and so he would like some company. And I think the initial response by the Democrats is going to be, you're doing fine there just by yourself, and there's no real reason for the Democratic leadership to go in and help the governor get off of his back. However, I think that's a temporary response, and I think as the legislature goes back into session and it's an election year and so on, people will get back into the business of wanting to get business done. I think there's a couple of areas that are ripe for bipartisan action that's relatively bold. The governor's notion and the legislative leadership talking about something on the order of a $50 billion capital investment bond is a very, very interesting issue. I have been saying for a couple of years, I think it should be $100 billion over four elections, where you put $25 billion a year on the general election ballot every 2 years, and that it is a mix of education, water, environment, affordable housing, schools, and that it is the invest in a better California future strategy. What the number is not important. But the fact that they are talking about something on the order of $50 billion would cause a big stretch on the part of Republicans who would have to say, you know, some of our pay-as-you-go ideas are going to have to be retooled to consider this an investment like other capital investments, which are paid for over time, just like buying your house is paid for over time. And Democrats are going to have to stretch to say that when you do that, you're going to further limit your budget ability going forward, because those will be general obligation bonds that will have first claim on the state's general funds and therefore further reduce that 14% that's currently available that's relatively discretionary and crank it down by 1 or 2 or 3 more percent and make the job more difficult to get to other areas of the budget. But I do think that this governor is interested in reprising the Edmund G. Brown senior administration in the sense of being a great builder of things, that there has been a lack of investment in the basics of this state for at least a generation and a half, and this governor, I think, wants to change the discussion and be viewed as someone leading on that. I think that's an area Democrats can see the opportunity for jobs in that, opportunity for serious investment in areas that have been where they have led in the past and not gotten everything they wanted. So I think that's an area that's ripe for a compromise.
Turning this Voices of Reform conversation into crossfire, I'd just like to ask briefly, Roger Nilo, if that is an assessment you share, is there an opportunity there for infrastructure advancement if the financing is handled in an appropriate manner?
A $50 billion bond offering would double the state's current bond indebtedness if it were done in the current time frame or near term, and rated against other states. We're currently, I think, ninth of 52 in percent of general fund and also or on a per capita basis. For that reason, that magnitude of a bond, I think, would be fiscally unwise given the existing structural deficit. So I fall out of bed with that idea with a bond of that size, particularly given that in the area of infrastructure, which most of that would go to, we have not given any, let alone adequate consideration, to potential private investment, which our side believes there can be substantial, to help address some of our infrastructure problem, public-private partnerships. And thirdly, the electorate would have to understand that a bond measure of that magnitude would create such pressure on the discretionary portion of the budget that there would either necessarily be dramatic cutbacks in discretionary funding, political pressure, again, on Prop 98, potential tax increases as a reality, and many people feel that maybe that's part of the motivation for the for such a large bond. Not to question motivations, but there are those that have said that. So it is problematic.
Not a good idea to question the motives of the Republican governor.
The modification Mike, I have a significant concern with regard to that proposal.
Well, I will simply note that I heard my friend Roger Nehlu say an infrastructure bond of that magnitude, and use that phrase several times. So if I were to take out my crystal ball for a moment, I suspect you will see some fairly heated negotiations on the magnitude of that type of proposal. I find it indicative that our conversation started as a very specific one, very specific about how to remedy a state budget process that all five of our panelists agreed is not working as effectively or as efficiently as it could. I also found it indicative that the conversation broadened out very, very quickly from specific policy or legislative or political fixes to the much broader philosophical challenges facing California state government and people it's supposed to represent. And finally, I found it very indicative that ultimately that conversation wound its way back to the specific rather than an abstract conversation of principles and priorities, a very specific conversation of what those policy priorities represent when discussed by individuals representing various communities and various constituencies. So we started out here talking about specific budget fixes. We broadened out to talking about much, much larger challenges that the state of California government faces. And finally, we got, I think, a couple of good examples of how those challenges are going to be played out in the weeks and months ahead, all of which is to say that I think we've had a phenomenal and a very enlightening discussion. So I'd like to thank our panelists for their contribution to tonight's discussion. They are Fred Keeley, the Treasurer and Tax Collector of Santa Cruz County.
Thank you.
Tim Gage, the former director of the State Department of Finance.
Thank you.
Peter Mijas, the superintendent of schools for Fresno County. Roger Nehlu, assemblyman representing Sacramento, California. And Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. He was unduly shy. We also thank our audiences, both here at the Convention Center and on the radio. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.